is a separate, discrete matter to be determined by the criminal laws. But just because your boss is a criminal doesn't make you a victim. Contrary to lugubrious news stories, there is no causal relationship between the boss selling his stock and the employee's losses. The reason the employees lost money is that Enron had a faulty business model and the company went bankrupt. Whenever a company collapses, the people who own it, stockholders, lose money. That's why people always tell you not to put all your money in a single company stock. Enron employees had 18 investment options, but many decided to invest heavily in the high-flying company stock. The only beef Enron employees have with top management is that management did not inform employees of the coming collapse in time to allow them to get in on the swindle, too. If Enron executives had shouted, "Head for the hills," the employees might have been able to sucker other Americans into buying their wildly overinflated Enron stock, as their bosses apparently did. The employees were victims only in the sense that they were not able to get in on the ripoff, too. Moreover, the billions of dollars Enron employees lost in paper profits, they had gained only in the last few years. Between 1997 and 2000, Enron's stock quadrupled in price, while the Standard & Poor's 500 index edged up only a few percentage points. In 2000, Enron's stock was trading at an astronomical 66 times recent earnings. Until 10 minutes ago, people who made a quick buck in the stock market were dot-com millionaire yuppie scum. Now, when the market collapses before they cash out, they are, as the Times puts it, the tale's most sympathetic characters, its victims. Compared with what the stock was worth in 1997, Enron employees lost an average of about $20,000 per employee in the largest company failure in U.S. history. I've lost more money on Social Security in that time, and no one's weeping for me. Liberals have leapt on Enron's collapse to try to persuade Americans to avoid the market altogether. They would prefer that the middle class put all its money under the mattress. The stock market, the Times instructs, is not for the little people because, as the headline of the Week in Review proclaimed, the rich are different. They know when to get out. Manifestly, the rich do not know when to get out. Otherwise, we wouldn't be hearing about the ripple effect of Enron's collapse hitting the likes of Citicorp, despite the lobbying efforts of billionaire Democrat Robert Rubin. The rich do, however, have more money, a point that is endlessly intriguing to liberals. The lesson liberals want the middle class to glean from this is, do not invest in the market. End hope. Trust Big Brother. It's Just About Money, July 25, 2002. Liberals' comprehension of corporate scandals is like the Woody Allen joke about reading Tolstoy's War and Peace in 20 minutes after taking a speed reading course. Question, what's it about? Answer, it involves Russia. George Bush and Dick Cheney's connection to corporate corruption consists primarily of the media's capacity to mention their names in the same sentence as corporate corruption 1 million times a day. Liberals think their saying someone's name in an accusatory tone of voice is sufficient to impute criminality to Republicans. Since Republicans are intrinsically evil, merely mentioning their names suffices to make any point liberals want to make. Bush and Cheney have bought and sold stock. The swine. Whenever the media start intoning darkly about perceptions, the full details, unanswered questions, and, most pathetic, the shadow of Enron, that rustling you hear is the sound of wool being pulled over your eyes. In fact, there are no unanswered questions about Bush and Cheney. There are only insipid insinuations. The facts are, Bush sold his stock in Harkin Energy to purchase the Texas Rangers. The price of the stock later went down, and then it went up to more than what he sold it for. Amid hectoring from liberals that he do so, Cheney sold his interest in Halliburton before he assumed the vice presidency to eliminate the possibility of a conflict of interest. Later, the price of that stock went down, in large part because trial lawyers were filing asbestos suits against Halliburton. It's not illegal to sell or buy stock. It's illegal to sell stock based on insider information that the price is about to tank, or to buy stock based on the insider information that the price is about to soar. Thus, the Democrats' theory is that Bush bought the Texas Rangers and Cheney became vice president only as part of wily scams to conceal their real reason for selling stock, insider information. Of this, there is no evidence. Literally, no evidence. In contradistinction to when liberals say there is no evidence, meaning there hasn't been a conviction in a court of law, but there is lots of evidence. The imputation of criminality to Bush and Cheney is so ludicrous that even in the girly girl eye-poking attacks on the New York Times op-ed page, it has been roundly admitted that there is no question of any criminality, Frank Rich, and that Mr. Bush broke no laws, Nicholas Kristof. Representative Barney Frank, the only honest Democrat in the House, has repeatedly said that it is not a case of Dick Cheney violating the law. Rather, the media explain their baseless sneering about the president and vice president as attempts to add to our knowledge of the ethics, policies, and personnel of a secretive administration, as Rich put it. It's a little late for liberals to pretend they care about ethics. These are the people who angrily defended a president who perjured himself, hid evidence, suborned perjury, was held in contempt by a federal court, was disbarred by the Supreme Court, and lied to his party, his staff, his wife, and the nation. The ethics of that president included having staff perform oral sex on him in the Oval Office as he chatted on the phone with a congressman about sending American troops into battle. The secular saints of liberalism indignantly defended all this on the grounds that it's fine to lie and commit crimes if it's just about sex. Well, evidently some corporate chieftains took that lesson to heart and concluded that it's also fine to commit crimes if it's just about money. Just as Ronald Reagan gave American culture a renewed patriotism and self-confidence that outlasted his presidency, Clinton has bequeathed America a culture of criminality and rationalization by the powerful. But still, somehow, Republicans are said to be more vulnerable whenever a businessman becomes a crook on the basis of their general support of capitalism. But if criminality and not capitalism is to blame, then Democrats are to blame for their general support of crooks. As part of the left's long-standing fanatical defense of their favorite criminal, Bill Clinton, it will be screeched that conservatives want to blame everything on Clinton, including the wacky idea that a direct assault on honor and honesty led some people to behave dishonorably and dishonestly. Not everything. But some of us called this ball and this pocket years ago. If Congress doesn't have the will to throw him out, Clinton will have set a new standard for the entire country. The new standard will be a total absence of standards. If you get caught and don't have a good enough legal team to escape, you might have to pay a fine or go to prison. But there's no shame in it. The country doesn't really condemn this. We adore a lovable rogue. It is fine to lie and cheat and manipulate because honor is just a word, just hot air, and the country doesn't believe in it. High Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Case Against Bill Clinton, 1998. It took a bear market to inexorably repeal the Clintonian national motto of just do it. This just in. Price controls cause shortages. February 2, 2001. Another dog bites man story has once again taken the American press corps by storm. California's electricity crisis is treated in the media as if it were some sort of natural disaster, like a hurricane. But the only fact of nature operating here is the hard and fast rule that whenever you come across a screw-up this big, you know the government is behind it. The California legislature created this problem about 5 years ago when it deregulated the wholesale market for electricity but fixed prices at the retail level. based on economic principles that have made Cuba the happy, prosperous country that it is today. Needless to say, eventually wholesale prices soared, but the utilities were prohibited from passing their increased costs on to consumers. Buy high, sell low. Isn't that what they teach you in business school? Since the California utilities are about to go bankrupt on the governmentally imposed buy high, sell low strategy, no one will sell them electricity. So now there's no electricity in California, but at least it's cheap. You are probably wondering how it is that multi-billion-dollar corporations with highly paid business school graduates populating their corporate risk management departments could have failed to anticipate price fluctuations in the electricity market and entered into long-term contracts. The answer is, remember what I said about screw-ups this big. California actually prohibited utilities from entering into long-term contracts. The California legislature came up with many other idiotic ways to mess up the electricity market. This is just the highlight reel. If California utilities had relied on evil, blood-sucking hedge fund managers rather than the California Centralized Committee to fix prices and plan markets, they'd have plenty of electricity now. To repeat, the California legislature fixed prices at which electricity could be sold to consumers and prohibited utilities from entering into long-term contracts to hedge the electricity market, leading like night into day to wild fluctuations in the price of electricity. But the utilities couldn't recoup their costs because the government had fixed prices in the retail market. In the mainstream media, this is known as deregulation. In point of fact, the California electricity crisis resulted from government policies that are the opposite of deregulation, the anti-matter of deregulation, as antithetical to deregulation as class and decorum are to Courtney Love. If the California legislature had helped the Soviet Union with its transition from communism to a market economy, the farmers would be experiencing their 84th year of bad weather again this year. Instead, only California utilities had bad weather. The utilities signed on to what was a politically attractive package at the time, and now it turns out they stepped on a rake and the rake hit them in the face. Why is it so difficult for people to grasp the advantages of a free market? It's never going to get any easier than this. Only a little over a decade ago, the centralized planning of the Eastern Bloc was exposed as having created a squalid, poverty-stricken abyss. Meanwhile, corrupt running dog lackeys of the capitalist system here in America managed to produce a society in which the poorest citizens have televisions, refrigerators, telephones, and the opportunity to appear on the Jerry Springer Show. But no matter how often capitalism manages to produce good products at low prices, and no matter how spectacular the failures of government intervention are, some segment of the population continually lists toward the old Soviet bread distribution model. Evidently, the free market is a counterintuitive concept. People have to be constantly reminded how excellent the market is at distributing goods and services. The basic idea of a free market is that the consumer and seller enter directly into mutually beneficial transactions. The consumer has the best information about what he wants and how much he is willing to pay. The seller has the best information about what he can provide and what it will cost him. That's how we end up with great products like reasonably priced Chia Pets in the shape of Jerry Garcia's head. The government bureaucrats' rallying cry is, insert a middleman. They simply cannot shake the conviction that they are in possession of the millions of constantly changing pieces of information that the market processes continually and effortlessly. If we ever let these bureaucrats run free, stores everywhere would run with the smooth Austrian precision of the Department of Motor Vehicles. Naturally, the California legislature's solution to a problem created by the government is more government. California voters ought to say what the Democratic Party is now gently trying to convey to Bill Clinton. Thanks, but you've already done enough. The Democrats' Laboratory, the host organism dies. August 13, 2003. In June 2002, the liberal American Prospect magazine was hailing California as a laboratory for Democratic policies, with its Democratic governor, U.S. senators, state legislature, and congressional delegation. Author Harold Meyerson gushed, "California is the only one of the nation's 10 largest states that is uniformly under Democratic control. In the Golden State," Meyerson said, "the next New Deal is in tryouts." Can't you just feel the tension building? Just a few years before that, the impresario of this adventure in Democratic governance, Governor Gray Davis, was being touted as presidential material, which wasn't nearly as insulting a thing to say to a politician back then as it is now that we've seen the current crop of Democrats running for president. Analyst Charles Cook said Davis was a major player in the Democratic Party. Around the time of the 2000 Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, Davis was forced to announce that he would decline offers to be Al Gore's running mate. Gore advisors cooed that Gray would certainly be one of those names that would have to be in the mix. Perhaps their campaign slogan could have been "Bland and Blander." Both were said to be cautious, moderate, new Democrats. Both were veterans, after a fashion, of Vietnam, which would make a Gore-Davis presidential ticket the only compelling argument yet in favor of friendly fire. California is, in fact, a perfect petri dish of Democratic policies. This is what happens when you let Democrats govern. You get a state, or, as it's now known, a job-free zone, with a $38 billion deficit, which is larger than the budgets of 48 states. There are reports that Argentina and the Congo are sending their fiscal policy experts to Sacramento to help stabilize the situation. California's credit rating has been slashed to junk bond status, and citizens are advised to stock up for the not-too-far-off day when cigarettes and Botox become the hard currency of choice. At this stage, we couldn't give California back to Mexico. Democrats governed their petri dish as they always govern. They buy the votes of government workers with taxpayer-funded jobs, salaries, and benefits, and then turn around and accuse the productive class of greed for wanting their taxes cut. This has worked so well nationally that more people in America now work for the government than work in any sort of manufacturing job. Strictly adhering to formula in California, as the private sector was bleeding jobs and money, Governor Davis signed off on comically generous pensions for government workers. Government employees in the Golden State earn more than the private sector workers who pay their salaries, and that's excluding the job security, health benefits, and 90% pension plans that come with Irish welfare, as government jobs used to be called. Economists refer to this backward ratio between public and private sector salaries as France. Inasmuch as they are paid more and work less than private sector employees, perhaps we could ease up on treating public school teachers like Mother Teresa washing the feet of the poor in Calcutta. The public sector unions repaid Davis with massive contributions to his reelection campaign. Davis bought himself reelection and is now the most hated officeholder in America. The people of California are willing to plunge their state into humiliation and chaos just to get rid of him in a recall election. The fact that Arianna Huffington hasn't been laughed off a stage yet is a pretty good gauge of the public's frustration with Governor Davis. And yet, Bill and Hillary Clinton and the rest of the Democratic Party think Gray Davis is doing a super job. Democrats have denounced the California recall, a genuine citizens' revolt, as a circus. According to recent polls, 2 out of 3 people in this overwhelmingly Democratic state want Davis out. And still the recall is being called a Republican power grab. Most touchingly, Democrats claim to be shocked at the exorbitant cost of a recall election. They were not such penny pinchers when contemplating Enron-style pensions for school crossing guards, nor did their fiscal conservatism kick in when Davis announced this week that he would sign legislation providing intolerance and hatred control training for all California schoolteachers. Yeah, this guy definitely deserves another crack at straightening out the budget. National Republicans are reluctant to let Davis go. They had been enjoying watching the Democrats' petri dish disintegrate into a parasite's paradise, so there were long faces all around when the Terminator threw his hat into the ring. No longer content to play an evil robot, actor Arnold Schwarzenegger will now be running against one. Far be it from me to tell Republicans to stop enjoying the Democrats' pain, but California is about to fall into the ocean. Either Schwarzenegger will come and dismantle the government employees' Versailles Palace, or California will continue to be a laboratory for failed liberal policies, and we won't be able to give it back to Mexico. 9 out of 10 caribou support drilling. April 18, 2002. Having wearied of opposing the war on terrorism, Democrats are now trying to sabotage the country's energy policy. George Bush has proposed drilling in a tiny, desolate portion of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR. A better idea, Democrats think, is to keep sending large amounts of money to countries that nurture homicidal Muslims intent on destroying America. ABC, NBC, CBS have been accompanying discussions of ANWR with picturesque footage of caribou frolicking in lush, fertile fields, all of which happens to be nowhere near the site of the proposed drilling. ANWR is 19 million acres, larger than Massachusetts, New Jersey, Hawaii, Connecticut, and Delaware combined. If oil is found, less than 2,000 acres would be directly affected. The area targeted for drilling looks a little like the moon, but less inviting. Consequently, Gail Norton, the Secretary of the Interior, responded to the campaign of lies by unveiling actual film footage of the area at issue. She sent a true and accurate film of the proposed drilling site to the networks and also posted the footage on the department's website. Representative Ed Markey of Massachusetts, Democrat, needless to say, claims this underhanded dissemination of the truth is illegal. Telling the truth is not merely contrary to the principles of the Democratic Party. Now they claim it's against the law. As Markey explains, the law prohibits agencies from promoting any film presentation designed to support or defeat legislation pending before the Congress. At least we have Markey on the record admitting that a truthful presentation of the proposed drilling site would persuade Congress to support drilling. According to a leading Democratic opponent of the plan, lying is the key to defeating ANWR. It was bad enough when Democrats just lied a lot themselves, purported not to know what is means, and claimed that everybody lied, perjured themselves, and suborned the perjury of others. Markey has staked out a more aggressive position by announcing that Republicans who tell the truth are breaking the law. ANWR exploration is overwhelmingly supported by Alaskans, Eskimos, Teamsters, and caribou. It is opposed by Northeastern liberals who would never set foot anywhere near ANWR and haven't the first idea what it looks like. The word wildlife in ANWR's title is somewhat misleading. The coastal plain, where the drilling would occur, is in total darkness half the year and reaches temperatures of 50 below zero. Most of the time, it is uninhabited and uninhabitable by wildlife. The only living things in the vicinity of the coastal plain, Eskimos and caribou, enthusiastically support drilling. When oil exploration began in Alaska's Prudhoe Bay 30 years ago, environmentalists claimed it would yield only a few months' supply of oil and would wreck the ecosystem. We started drilling, and Prudhoe Bay turned out to be the largest deposit of oil ever found in North America. Not only that, but the caribou of the famous ecosystem loved the pipeline. They frolic and play by it, leaping to and fro near the warmth. Apparently, the pipeline makes them frisky, too. In 20 years, the caribou population has skyrocketed from 3,000 to almost 27,100. The Teamsters have been huge supporters of drilling in Anwar, but Democrats treat union members the way they treat blacks. Vote for us, and we'll give you nothing. Ed, the truth is illegal Markey, responded to Teamster support for Anwar by dismissively sniffing that it was only one issue. Democrats expect union money and endorsements, but when the prospect of 500,000 high-paying jobs comes along, the Democrats tell workers it's only one issue. Luckily, the Democrats have all those other issues dear to the heart of the average blue-collar worker: abortion on demand, gay marriage, and taxpayer-funded crucifixes submerged in urine. So much for everyone sacrificing for the war on terrorism. Little old ladies get strip-searched at airports, but the environmentalists won't budge on an uninhabitable wasteland at the continent's edge. The Democrats' idea of sacrifice after 9/11 is for Senator Teddy Kennedy to stop getting drunk on airplanes and goosing stewardesses. When not jetting around the country on his private plane, paid for by the deceased husband of his second wife, Senator John Kerry has emerged as a leading opponent of Anwar. Developing new sources of energy, Kerry says, is old thinking. The Democrats' innovative new thinking is for the little people to wear sweaters and drive smaller cars. That's a bold stroke. We'll delay starvation by eating a little less each day. The illogic of it confounds reason. Everyone is against waste, except Democrats telling the rest of us to conserve from their Gulfstream private jets. How about they set an example by conserving our money? We need more energy. Postponing death is not an energy policy. Markey has similarly innovative ideas. He proposes that we bring OPEC to its knees by our technological superiority. What he means by technological superiority is this: let's make SUVs get 30 miles a gallon. How about we make cars and airplanes that run on dirt or hot air and run a pipeline from the Capitol? There is not a thinking man's Democrat in the country. If only caribou voted instead of Democrats, the country would finally have a serious energy policy. All the news we heard from a guy at Handgun Control, Inc., May 16, 2002. Having been assured by Handgun Control, Inc., a.k.a. the Brady Campaign, that the Constitution protects only kiddie porn and says absolutely nothing about guns, the New York Times has been viciously denouncing Attorney General John Ashcroft for having the temerity to suggest that the Second Amendment protects the right of the people to keep and bear arms. This, the Times proclaims, is radical, ominous, and a betrayal of Ashcroft's public duty. In an eerie coincidence, the Second Amendment actually says, "The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." In its inimitable Stalinist style, the Times claims Ashcroft's position is contrary to long-standing and bipartisan interpretation of the Second Amendment. This is always how liberals engage in obvious jabberwocky. They smugly announce a broad consensus among respected academics, meaning one of their interns went to the trouble of calling Handgun Control, Inc. First of all, any journalist who is completely unaware that there is debate about the Second Amendment ought to be fired. But more preposterously, though a bipartisan consensus has begun to develop, it has gone heavily against the Times' position. For over a decade now, liberal law professors keep setting out to disprove the pro-gun extremists, as the Times calls people who disagree with the Times. Gleefully intending to establish that the Second Amendment refers only to the right of state militias to have guns, the professors invariably conclude, with great lugubriousness, that the gun nuts are right. By now, the growing roster of law professors who support the radical, ominous Ashcroft position includes Larry Tribe of Harvard, Akil Amar of Yale, and Sanford Levinson of the University of Texas. In happier circumstances, these professors are known as respected at the Times. Among sitting Supreme Court justices, five have raised the Second Amendment in opinions just since 1990. The Second Amendment even made a cameo appearance in the very opinion that constitutes definition of constitutional law at the Times, Roe v. Wade. Every single one of those citations assumes that the right to bear arms belongs to the people, not only militia members. Indeed, the one guy the Times dredged out of the left-wing toilet, willing to provide tepid endorsement to their bunkum, was Stanford history professor Jack Rakove. Even Rakove, the only academic still defending Michael Belisile's fraudulent anti-gun book Arming America, wouldn't stoop to supporting the Times' preposterous claims. Far from asserting a bipartisan consensus for the Times' view, Rakove said it is no secret that controversy over the Second Amendment has escalated in recent years, except at the Times, where it remains a huge secret. Moreover, Rakove's big rebuke to Ashcroft consisted of his meek observation that it is far from clear that the Justice Department's new position would prevail. For taking a position that an anti-gun zealot says might not prevail, the Times says Ashcroft is betraying his public duty. But for bald-faced lies, nothing beats the Times' preposterous characterization of Supreme Court precedent. The most recent case directly raising the Second Amendment was United States v. Miller, decided in 1939. Any conservative who demanded deference to a case from 1939 would be accused of trying to lynch blacks and brutalize women. The Miller case simply defined the types of guns protected by the Second Amendment, not who was entitled to have guns. Reviewing the case of two bootleggers charged with failing to pay federal taxes on a sawed-off shotgun, the court concluded that the instrument was not covered by the Second Amendment. Since the Times lies about the relevant language, I will quote it in full. In the absence of any evidence tending to show that possession or use of a shotgun having a barrel of less than 18 inches in length at this time has some reasonable relationship to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia, we cannot say that the Second Amendment guarantees the right to keep and bear such an instrument. Certainly, it is not within judicial notice that this weapon is any part of the ordinary military equipment or that its use could contribute to the common defense. The vigilant observer will note that the court did not find that since the defendants were bootleggers and not members of a militia, they had no Second Amendment rights. Rather, the court's conclusion turned solely on the fact that a sawed-off shotgun was not ordinary military equipment. As Professor Levinson, card-carrying member of the ACLU, said of the decision, "Ironically, Miller can be read to support some of the most extreme anti-gun control arguments, e.g. that the individual citizen has a right to keep and bear bazookas, rocket launchers, and assault weapons." Now observe how the Times mischaracterizes the Miller decision. In a ham-handed deception, the Times substitutes the word rights for guns and claims that the court found that the Second Amendment protects only those rights that have some reasonable relationship to the preservation of efficiency of a well-regulated militia. If the Times is going to dismiss the views of Harvard and Yale law professors, Supreme Court justices, and constitutional scholars Joseph Story and Thomas Cooley, in deference to the press releases of a fanatical anti-gun lobbying group, they might want to find one with smarter lawyers than Handgun Control, Inc. Chapter 7. More Liberal Ideas. Sex, Segregation, Gay Marriage, and Banning the G-Word. God. Chicks with Bleep. January 2000. Or about 1 year before, Vanity Fair noticed Sex and the City was about gay men, even though everyone yelled at me for saying it in George magazine. It's getting so you can't turn on the TV or open a newspaper without hearing some girl boasting about her latest sexual conquest. From Hollywood starlets embarrassing the adorable Conan O'Brien with their inane prattle about phallic symbols, masturbation, and breast augmentation, to every tabloid in the country publishing preposterous female sex columnists, it seems as if the country has been inhabited by an alien breed of women. The first thing that strikes you about the slutty girls phenomenon is, this is not how women talk. This is how some men might talk, if women would let them. We have some idea what that sounds like. Some men, oddly enough, aren't willing to curb their instinctive promiscuity and embrace monogamy in order to get a girl. They're known as gay men. See if you can spot the cultural clues here. In HBO's Sex and the City, a classic in the slutty girl genre, the fictional characters blather endlessly about anal sex, oral sex, casual sex, wrinkled buttocks, spanking, boy toys, sex toys, and the ennui of marriage. This is not girls talking like girls. It's not even girls talking like guys, exactly, but girls talking like gay men. Another hint is that the only appealing male character is a gay man. The odd thing is, this campy joke of women playing gay men is apparently lost on everyone outside of Manhattan, at least if you credit the hayseeds who have been eagerly furnishing miss-the-point quotes to various news outlets. Girls living out in America steadfastly insist they find Sex and the City totally realistic. "I feel like they really are saying the things we're all thinking," Alana Peters told the New York Times. Are sweet Southern belles in Atlanta really all thinking about sex in coarse euphemisms for body parts, as the Times delicately describes the dialogue on Sex and the City? And is Alana's boyfriend having sex with his dog? That was one recent episode. Please, they're lying. But why? Curiously, claims about the amazing realism of Sex and the City are often accompanied by defensive statements about how cosmopolitan Atlanta or Milwaukee is. "We are a mini New York here," proclaimed Atlanta resident Laura Priester, explaining her enthusiasm for the show to a Times reporter. "It's not like we're Scarlett O'Hara and we get all upset when people swear." Oh dear, these girls seem to imagine Sex and the City is real. In the cheese state, Pam Schlesner was quoted in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel saying she, too, sees herself in the fictional characters. Really? The ones encouraging one another to have anal sex? That episode drove a reviewer from the Village Voice to remark that the character's enthusiasm was the tip-off that a man wrote the scene. And yet, Ms. Schlesner praised the dead-on accuracy of Sex and the City, saying the show's writing crew must follow her around for script fodder. More probably, Pam is following the show for life fodder. Pam said she and her friends recently took it upon themselves to spend a weekend having sex like a man, a hobby of the Sex and the City characters, picking up strangers for sex and then plotting to get the studs out of their homes as early in the morning as possible. This is taking New York envy to dangerous extremes. A few years ago, I realized that my friends in the Midwest, avid Seinfeld devotees, had no idea that Jerry Seinfeld was Jewish. But that was merely droll. It did not lead them to invite Ted Bundy back to their apartments for sex. Okay, Miss Cheese State, we won't call you a backwater hick, but think hard. Do you actually know girls who talk about sex using the D word and C word to describe specific body parts? No, you don't. You know gay men who do. See, e.g., The Village Voice. Indeed, even the show's perky star, Sarah Jessica Parker, reportedly uses language no coarser than "Oh God" or "Geez Louise" off the set. Girls talking the way they do on Sex and the City is about as realistic as George Bush playing a gangster rapper, talking about hoes and bitches. Instead of wiping away years of humorless feminist tyranny, this new breed of smutty girls have taken the error of the feminists and raised it. There are differences between boys and girls. One of the big ones is, girls do not relentlessly pursue casual sex. In one famous study conducted at the University of Hawaii, and one that drives the sexual egalitarians crazy, male and female researchers approached single college students of the opposite sex in bars to propose only one of three options. 1, a date. 2, going back to the questioner's apartment. Or 3, immediate sex. 50% of men accepted the date, 69% agreed to go back to the apartment, and 75% agreed to immediate sex. Half the women agreed to a date, 6% consented to go to the apartment, and none, zero, agreed to sex. Not to belabor the obvious, but the only girls who actively seek casual sex seem to be girls in Milwaukee who think sex in the city is how the cool New York City chicks really behave. Or girls in New York City who think sex in the city is how the cool New York City chicks really behave. Meanwhile, gay men totally get it. Hell, a gay man writes it. The TV show Sex in the City is the creation of wunderkind Darren Star. Star was also the creator of Melrose Place and Central Park West, described in the press as almost cultishly gay faves. The openly gay Star sardonically remarked of his Sex in the City creation, "I guess I just have a strong feminine side." Not long after the original Sex in the City column debuted in the New York Observer, the New York Times reported that the boys at World Gym said in a fan letter that they were convinced the authoress was a gay man in a woman's body. That's the irony. While being celebrated for being so very outré, even Hollywood is not ready to let gay men out of the closet, but has to disguise them in women's bodies. December 5th, 2003. Trent Lott toasts Strom Thurmond at Thurmond's 100th birthday party. Democrats, a lot of trouble. December 18th, 2002. I'm just glad Strom Thurmond isn't around to see this. Statisticians believe Trent Lott is now on track to break Bill Clinton's single-season record for public apologies. During his recent BET appearance, Lott said he supported affirmative action and regretted voting against the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, and that he'd give the Bernie Mac show another try. What the Lott incident shows is that Republicans have to be careful about letting Democrats into our party. Back when they supported segregation, Lott and Thurmond were Democrats. This is something the media are intentionally hiding to make it look like the Republican Party is the party of segregation and race discrimination, which it never has been. In 1948, Thurmond did not run as a Dixiecan, he ran as a Dixiecrat. His party was an offshoot of the Democratic Party. And when he lost, he went right back to being a Democrat. This whole brouhaha is about a former Democrat praising another former Democrat for what was once a Democrat policy. Republicans made Southern Democrats drop the race nonsense when they entered the Republican Party. Democrats supported race discrimination. Then, for about 3 years, they didn't. Now they do again. They've just changed which race they think should be discriminated against. In the 1920s, the Democratic platforms didn't even call for anti-lynching legislation, as the Republican platforms did. Thurmond's Dixiecrat Party was not the only extremist spinoff from the Democratic Party in 1948. Henry Wallace, formerly FDR's vice president and agriculture secretary, left the Democratic Party that year to form the communist-dominated and Soviet-backed Progressive Party. Much as Thurmond's Dixiecrat Party was expressly pro-segregation, Wallace's Progressive Party was expressly pro-Soviet. Indeed, this was the apex of Moscow-directed subversion of U.S. politics. The Progressive Party platform excluded even the mildest criticism of Soviet aggression. It will come as no surprise that many American celebrities supported Wallace. The Progressives received 1 million votes nationwide, about the same as Thurmond's Dixiecrat Party. Thurmond went on to reject segregation, become a Republican, and serve his country well as a U.S. senator. By contrast, running a communist-dominated presidential campaign was Wallace's last hurrah. Yet only an off-the-cuff remark at a birthday party praising Thurmond's presidential campaign is the career destroyer. Not so fawning references to Wallace's Soviet-backed presidential campaign. Just 2 years before Lott's remarks, a hagiographic book on Wallace's life was released, American Dreamer. How about a book about a segregationist titled American Dreamer? Wallace's version of the American dream was communism, every bit as much as Strom Thurmond's dream was segregation. Aren't dreams of murderous dictators, gulags, and death camps at least comparable in evil to segregated lunch counters? The dust jacket on American Dreamer featured a nauseating statement of praise by Senator Edward Kennedy. Kennedy said that the book deserved to be read by all who care about the American dream. The American dream, communist totalitarianism. Why wasn't the lecherous liberal asked to retire for his flattering remarks about a proven Soviet fifth columnist? In 1999, the Clinton administration dedicated a room at the Agriculture Department to Wallace. At the dedication, former Democratic presidential candidate George McGovern gave a speech explicitly praising Wallace's pro-Soviet positions, such as the idea that the Cold War was overdone and that problems between the nations could not be resolved by military means. McGovern fondly recalled that he himself had voted for Wallace. He chipperly reminded the audience that he had run for president in 1972 on a similar platform, with the help of a young Yale Law School graduate named Bill Clinton. Inasmuch as Trent Lott was in kindergarten in 1948, he did not vote for Thurmond. He did not run on a similar platform to the Dixiecrats. He did not write a jacket flap endorsement calling a segregationist an American dreamer. The idea that Lott took the occasion of an old-timer's birthday to introduce a new policy initiative to bring back segregation, a Democrat policy, is ludicrous. Lott is a fine fellow. He just has some sort of liberal Tourette syndrome that makes him spout Democrat ideas at random. A few years ago, Lott practically wanted to give the adulterous Air Force pilot Kelly Flynn a Silver Star for her service. Remember that? Up until 2 weeks ago, conservatives were clamoring for Lott's removal precisely because of his annoying habit of saying dumb things. Showing their inferior intellect, liberals have only recently figured that out. Republicans should ask Lott to step down as leader, but only for all the nice things he said about Teddy Kennedy. Ashcroft and the Blowhard discuss desegregation. January 18, 2001. Republican presidents need to start sending at least one Potemkin nominee to the Senate for confirmation hearings. If there were just one cabinet nominee willing to sacrifice his appointment for the opportunity to yell back at that adulterous drunk, Senator Teddy Kennedy might not be so cavalier before launching his premeditated vituperations. Whatever else the Stop, Fill In Name Here task force can say about John Ashcroft, they cannot say that he drunkenly plunged a woman to a horrifying, watery death and then fled the scene of the accident, relying on his family's connections to paper over the woman's drowning. Indeed, Ashcroft has never done anything drunkenly, making him an object of fascination for Mr. Kennedy. They cannot say that John Ashcroft, like Senator Kennedy, was thrown out of college for cheating on a Spanish test, or that he got into college on the basis of his family pedigree. Inasmuch as Ashcroft attended an Ivy League college, it was not much help having a father who was a Pentecostal minister rather than, say, a bootlegger. And a pantsless, drunken John Ashcroft has never been wandering nearby while his nephew was having sex with a woman whom he had just met and who subsequently accused him of rape at the family compound in Florida on Good Friday. The Ashcroft family doesn't even have a compound in Florida. Poor John Ashcroft couldn't say any of that when Senator Kennedy erupted in gin-soaked venom at Ashcroft's nomination hearings. He has higher aspirations than talking back to a dissolute slob for laughs. But surely there is someone out there who would go for laughs. Bush should find that guy. Heck, I'll volunteer for this mission myself, if only for the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to say on C-SPAN, "We'll drive off the side of that bridge when we come to it, Senator Kennedy." On the first day of the Ashcroft hearings, Senator Kennedy waxed nostalgic over a court-ordered voluntary desegregation plan imposed by an unelected judge on the good people of Kansas City back in the 1980s. Kennedy issued blood-curdling screams about the kids. "How costly was this going to be, Senator Ashcroft, before you were going to say that those kids going in lousy schools, that you were going to do something about it?" You remember what a fabulous success court-ordered desegregation plans have been. Few failures have been more spectacular. Illiterate students knifing one another between acts of sodomy in the stairwell is just one of the many eggs that had to be broken to make the left's omelet of transferring power from cities to the federal courts. In the case of the Kansas City schools, a judge issued an edict doubling the property taxes of the school district's residents. 12 years and $2 billion later, the district is more racially segregated than it was before. Test scores are lower for black students than in the rest of the state. This is the remedy Senator Drung Kennedy was so passionately defending. It's one thing for the federal courts to inform the states and localities that they cannot discriminate on the basis of race. That was duly accomplished back in 1954. It's really quite another for unelected judges to be imposing $2 billion property taxes and ordering school districts to build opulent school campuses replete with Olympic-sized pools, 25-acre wildlife sanctuaries, and a model United Nations with simultaneous translation facilities. The only way this plan could have been more absurd would be if school board members had begun actually, literally throwing bundles of cash at the students. But that's what a federal judge did to Kansas City, under the Olympic-sized pool and tax-them-till-they-scream clauses of the U.S. Constitution. As a matter of technical constitutional law, the Constitution does not strictly require states to provide public school students with petting farms. What happened was that over the past several decades, federal judges got it into their heads that black students had to sit next to white students in order to learn. It was all the rage at the elite universities, Harvard in particular. Justice Clarence Thomas responded to the theory by saying, "It never ceases to amaze me that the courts are so willing to assume that anything that is predominantly black must be inferior." The idea was that if the federal courts ordered the states to spend gobs of money building model schools with petting farms and highly paid teachers' unions in the mostly black city schools, the all-important white students would come. Surrounded by white people, black students' education would improve. The popular appeal of this charming notion gives you some idea why the most frequent modifier to federal judge is unelected. Needless to say, having federal judges and Harvard professors run local school districts on the basis of a preposterous racist theory wrecked school system after school system. Federal judges managed to wrest control of the school systems in the first place through scam lawsuits between non-adverse parties. It worked like this. A few parents would sue the school board, and the school board would quickly admit guilt. Then the non-adverse adversaries would giddily enter voluntary settlements requiring the school boards to make lavish improvements, including generous salary increases for school administrators. The court would enter an order confirming the voluntary settlement, and the taxpayers would be stuck with the bill. It was nothing but a scam dreamed up by parents and school boards to bilk taxpayers for more money. The educational community refers to this as a court-ordered remedy. In the real world, such arrangements are known as organized crime. These voluntary desegregation plans were voluntary in the same way you volunteer your wallet to a couple of con men who have just staged a phony confrontation to abet picking your pocket. As Ashcroft explained it to Senator Kopechne, parents and schools would enter into agreements, but the state was going to have to pay for everything. The plans had as much to do with desegregation as, well, a pickpocket does. It's time for Bush to send in Alan Keyes. He could probably explain all this to the Massachusetts drunk with some trenchancy. Bizarre political sect ousted from judicial nomination process. March 28, 2001. A few years ago, I was bitterly disappointed to discover that appellate court judge Pasco Bowman, the otherwise impeccable federal judge I clerked for after law school, had gotten a qualified rating from the ABA. Maybe even, God forbid, well qualified. I don't remember. It was a dark day. For those of you not familiar with the ABA, this would be the equivalent of a would-be ethicist getting a two-thumbs-up rating from Bill and Hillary. Upon discovering this contretemps, I called him to complain. Almost all the cool guys had gotten qualified/not-qualified ratings. Why not him? Oh, the humiliation! Among the judicial nominees who won the ABA's coveted qualified/not-qualified rating is Judge Richard Posner. Once described by arch-liberal Supreme Court Justice William Brennan, Jr., as one of the two geniuses he had met in his life. Others were Judges Frank Easterbrook, Stephen Williams, James Buckley, Jerry Smith, and Lawrence Silberman. If jurisprudence were an Olympic sport, these guys would be the dream team, as would Judge Bowman, but for nagging questions about that ABA endorsement. Clarence Thomas got an impressive qualified/not-qualified rating from the ABA, the lowest score ever given to a Supreme Court nominee. Meanwhile, David Souter, that jurisprudential giant, plucked from a state court where he had been deciding pig trespassing cases, was unanimously voted highly qualified. Finally, and most acclaimed, the ABA Ratings Committee couldn't decide whether Judge Robert Bork, one of the 20th century's foremost constitutional and legal authorities, was qualified. Four members voted him not qualified, thus clearly defining qualified as favoring unrestricted abortion on demand. The head of the ABA Selection Committee then perjured himself by telling a Senate committee reasonable minds could differ about Bork's qualifications. Oh, okay. How about we compare LSAT scores? There was no possibility the ABA could ever be a non-laughable organization after that. Demonstrating its eagle eye for ferreting out unfit judges, the ABA gave qualified or well-qualified ratings to all three federal judges impeached in the last half century. These were Harry E. Claiborne, appointed by Lyndon Johnson, Alcee L. Hastings, appointed by Jimmy Carter, and Walter L. Nixon, appointed by Jimmy Carter. Perhaps this is all a big misunderstanding, and what the ABA's rating system really means is well-qualified for future impeachment. This does not include other stellar Carter appointees who served prison terms without ever being impeached, like U.S. District Judge Robert F. Collins of New Orleans. While serving a 6-year sentence for taking part of a $100,000 bribe to fix a drug smuggling case, Collins continued to receive his federal salary from prison. He even got a raise. Only when the House brought impeachment proceedings against him did Collins finally resign. The ABA had ruled Collins qualified. In my judge's defense, 1. Justice Antonin Scalia also got qualified/well-qualified ratings. Keep your eye on that guy. And 2. Despite the ABA adjudging him qualified, Judge Bowman has never been impeached. Magazines like The Economist and Time actually cited the impeachments of Democratic-appointed ABA-approved judges in order to denounce Reagan's judicial nominees for getting low marks from the ABA. The Economist mentioned Judge Hastings, ABA rating qualified, and Judge Claiborne, ABA rating highly qualified, before asserting that criminal indictments of judges were rare, largely because screening of candidates for federal judgeships is so much more rigorous. Time magazine repeatedly pondered the irony of the Senate voting on Reagan's nomination of Daniel Mannion, whom 40 law school deans had opposed, just a month after highly qualified Claiborne began serving a 2-year criminal sentence. Judge Mannion has served with distinction since his appointment in 1986. On the basis of the ABA's record, one could certainly understand why Senate Democrats like Chuck Schumer and Patrick Leahy were upset when President George Bush decided to scrap the ABA's review. You wouldn't want to tinker with a fine-tuned system like that. Schumer said eliminating the ABA's role in judicial nominations showed that, instead of quality, they are looking for ideology. Schumer then voted against Bush nominee Miguel Estrada, who had graduated from Harvard Law School magna cum laude, where he had been an editor of the Law Review, had clerked for the Supreme Court, had been a federal prosecutor, had served for almost 5 years in the Solicitor General's office, had argued more than a dozen cases before the Supreme Court, and was then a partner in one of the most prestigious law firms in the country. Because Estrada had not given the Democrats a blood oath that he would uphold abortion on demand. The New York Times also attacked Bush for removing the ABA from the process, editorializing that the ABA's ratings were crucial because its stamp of approval gave people confidence that federal judges were highly regarded members of the profession. If so, only among people who weren't paying attention. I've been going to ABA annual conventions every few years since my parents took me as a little kid. It used to be that you couldn't get on an elevator at the hotel without stepping on a Supreme Court justice, an appellate court judge, or a U.S. senator. Big, important people gave big, important speeches. Now it's all nobodies. Every single panel discussion is on women and minorities. Once a convocation of esteemed legal minds, the ABA convention has morphed into a weird sort of 12-step meeting for the disbarred. That's not entirely fair. The ABA still has marquee speakers, but instead of prominent attorneys, now they're prominent criminals. After he was impeached and held in contempt by a federal court, but before he had his license to practice law suspended and was banned from ever appearing before the U.S. Supreme Court, the ABA invited Bill Clinton to speak. Also joining the list of celebrated felons speaking at the ABA was ex-con Webster Hubbell. Apparently, Hubbell was a last-minute stand-in after Mumia Abul-Jamal dropped out because of a scheduling conflict. Maybe they could get O.J. for one of the minority panels next year. There's no one left to complain. Everyone serious has resigned. The first wave of resignations came in 1987, when the ABA couldn't decide on Judge Bork's qualifications. The next major exodus came in 1992 when, on a break from Yaya sisterhood meetings, the ABA's House of Delegates declared the ABA in favor of abortion on demand. For the next several months, thousands of members exercised their freedom to choose by terminating their ABA memberships. After that, the ABA got loopier and loopier. One distinguished federal judge claims to join every few years just so he can resign in protest. Another said he was compelled to resign because the impartiality of any judge who continues to belong to the ABA is subject to serious question. For years now, the ABA has been issuing wild proclamations more appropriate to Jeanine Garofalo than a professional association of lawyers. One former ABA president, George Bushnell, called the Republican leadership in Congress reptilian bastards, paraphrasing the noted constitutional scholar and dictionary buff Julia Roberts. Why couldn't my judge have gotten that appellation? The esteemed ABA president also called the contract with America an attack on the Constitution comparable to that of the invasion of our shores by foreign forces. You remember the contract with America. It included pernicious ideas like a balanced budget amendment and tax incentives for adoption. If I had a nickel for every time I've confused an armed invasion of the U.S. mainland with a balanced budget amendment, John Kerry would be trying to raise my taxes right now. Two ABA presidents viciously denounced a proposed flag-burning amendment to the Constitution and, most shockingly, didn't even wait for the results of a study on how flag burning might contribute to global warming. One former president, Roberta Ramo, said the flag burning amendment proved Congress had lost sight of the United States Constitution and Bill of Rights as our nation's lodestar and our soul. Instead of saluting the American flag, the ABA is considering a special seminar on how to burn it. Bushnell said Senator Bob Dole's support for the flag-burning amendment had compromised his decency as an individual, proving that it's still okay to vilify a disabled American combat veteran who actually did sustain his injuries on the field of battle. The decency police at the ABA were offended by Bob Dole, but they didn't have a problem with Bernardine Dorn, the Charles Manson-admiring former weatherman and erstwhile member of the FBI's 10 Most Wanted. The ABA made Dorn head of their litigation task force on children. As Bushnell said, "We are tremendously fortunate to have her." That is true in the sense that it is somewhat miraculous that Dorn didn't blow herself up making pipe bombs as a member of the Weathermen back in the 1970s. But my judge is qualified. Coming from this gang of leftist fringe kooks, them's fighting words. I demand a recount. Liberals shocked. Rush, not Jesus Christ. October 15, 2003. So liberals have finally found a drug addict they don't like. And unlike the Lackawanna Six, those high-spirited young lads innocently seeking adventure in an Al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan, liberals could find no excuses for Rush Limbaugh. After years of the mainstream media assuring us that Rush was a has-been, a nobody yesterday's news, the Rush painkiller story was front-page news last week. Would anyone care if Howell Raines committed murder? The airwaves and print media were on red alert with Rush's admission that after an unsuccessful spinal operation a few years ago, he became addicted to powerful prescription painkillers. Rush Limbaugh's misfortune is apparently a bigger story than his nearly $300 million radio contract signed 2 years ago.